Gary asked me to talk a little bit about part of the TDLC network that I'm very excited about, and perhaps one of the most profound parts and goals of the entire Science of Learning Center vision is to take on this very, very difficult task of how are we going to relate very particular phenomena and observations that happen at this level of really talented scientists studying the neural dynamics and temporal dynamics of human brain activity and relate it to researchers and practitioners that are studying a very different level of complexity and very different phenomena, and how to make very specific connections across these two very, very different worlds. And can I just get a show of hands in the audience of people who hear from the teachers network who are educators? And everybody else is not, I can infer. So I was really interested to see some of the conversations that were happening at, you know, now that this is a very unique situation in which educators have come back year after year to the same exact scientific all-hands meeting, have been integrated into it, and talking to some people about where are the very specific connections, a lot of really difficult and challenging things come up when you try to really specify where are the levels of observations that are going to link discoveries and things that are happening at the level of the brain with dynamics that are actually going to take on and transform what's happening at the societal level when we're trying to change people's brains through these educational activities. And there's been a couple of really stellar examples that you get very excited about. Gary wrote about it in the newsletter about mass versus space practice and being able to link to explanations in the hippocampus about why. I'm going to talk about how to link these two and what I've noticed as being very kind of useful observations across my research in the development of reading, and try to draw out just a basic story and walk you through some of both the science of brain science of visual word recognition and how it supports literacy, as well as how this might connect to making changes in classrooms. And I want to point out that this is a challenge which has societal significance. It's very, very important. It's not necessarily very easy to take a very diverse and complex population of children and change their brain activity, change their functional brain activity so that they can engage in things like fluent literacy. This is a map of success and failure in the New York City public school systems. It was published in the New York Times. And the most frightening part of this is the scale, in which light gray means that greater than 70% of the fourth graders are failing to meet the basic proficiency that we set out for being barely functionally literate so that you can survive as a fourth grader moving into the higher grades. Some people who know the distribution of wealth patterns in New York City might see some correlation here between resources that are available and success that's occurring. But overall, it just points out that some of the challenges that we're looking at, how do we understand some of these basic transformations that happen late in childhood that are directly modulated by the quality of their educational experiences? How can we start to understand that at a brain dynamics level? And how is it that very specific observations or very specific tools and assays at the brain dynamics level are going to help us to potentially address these really challenging problems? So when I think about this, I think most of the fundamental insights that come from cognitive neuroscience really happen at the level of functional organization in experts. This is the bread and butter of cognitive neuroscience, is where most of the research is happening, really understanding how does the typical expert adult functioning, what are the functional circuits that are involved. Cognitive neuroscience is giving us a lot of purchase into those, but the tools and observations that come out of that can be very useful now that we have the ability to look at functional changes that are occurring during development, functional changes that are emerging as the child goes from being a pre-reader to a highly skilled reader. But a very different aspect of cognitive neuroscience that I think is going to have an even more profound interaction with education is taking this beyond general principles that we think cover the central tendency of most individuals as they develop, to start to look at neural correlates of very specific individual differences. There are great individual differences in nearly any aptitude that you can assay, and those can be linked directly to individual differences in neural processes that we can start to understand at a more principled level. And it really takes on a new dynamic when you can start interacting with educators to say, I have insight into why one child might be different from another, in terms of how the challenge that they're facing in education. And this might provide insights to help us investigate experience-driven changes in function. So I want to take the example of early literacy and visual word recognition. Specifically because it's a really interesting challenge for the human brain. If you think about literacy, it's a relatively new invention, and it requires of nearly the entire population to pull off a brand new systems-level reorganization of function, where we have an intense interaction between visual pattern analysis and particular representations that are associated with phonological forms of auditory speech, such that within a very rapid amount of time, somebody can directly access exactly which phonological form is associated with a written form. This involves a reorganization of brain areas that might be particularly responsive to visual letters and visual words, mapped out here in red, and brain regions that are specifically and intricately activated by auditory sounds, such as the elementary sounds within speech corresponding roughly to the letter levels. One of the interesting things about thinking about this in a developmental and educational context is the notion that individual differences in the organization of these systems that individual children bring to the task of plastically reorganizing these systems can have a profound impact on the development of these systems. Another aspect of this is that we can start to map out the changes that occur within a particular visual region as children get increasing experience, hundreds or thousands of hours recognizing visual words. We can start to look at functional changes that happen within particular systems that we can use to start to get insight into the development of the system. So we've been looking at this system. This is thinking that's been actually influenced very early on by the perceptual expertise network. We know that having hundreds or thousands of hours specializing your visual cortex for the recognition of human faces leads to very distinct changes in the mid-fusiform gyrus. We can also ask the very same question about visual word recognition. How is it that very, very late in childhood, when children spend hundreds and thousands of hours looking at visual word forms, there are changes that occur in the visual system, and what are those changes? This work has, as we summarized with a publication with Stan Dehane and colleagues, we summarized the vast literature looking at the development of visual word recognition and the organization of visual word recognition in adults, and drew a really great number of parallels between what we see in visual word recognition and what we see in perceptual expertise for a number of domains. But there were a few things that were actually quite different, which suggests that visual words may take on very different dynamic properties over the course of specialization. One of those differences is that visual word recognition, passive viewing of visual words, leads to really nice peaked responses in this left fusiform gyrus region. It's profoundly left lateralized in the majority of subjects that we look at. And this is not generally true of the vast domain of perceptual expertise phenomena. There are large differences in lateralization, but very few domains lead to a really profound and consistent left lateralization. In a way that we're able to see here. We see many of the other same hallmarks of perceptual expertise, such as perceptual tuning and many other things, but that's not the focus of this talk. What I'm hoping to show you is that some of the basic insights from the science of just trying to figure out how the expert adult is wired up may give us insights into the dynamic process and the challenge that we have to face when we're trying to create this circuit in the first place. One hypothesis that we floated, and there are still many, and I don't think that we have definitive answers to this, is the notion that what might be very specific to this domain of visual word recognition as a different problem from many other forms of perceptual expertise is this intense need, computationally, for the integration of orthographic visual information with left lateralized phonological information. So the very nature of reading is creating an integration between left lateralized regions of the brain that are specialized for processing the forms of auditory language, and linking those directly to complex analysis of visual form to know which salient parts of the visual form are relevant in order to create this computational circuit. We propose that the left lateralization of this phonological region and its intense integration between visual processing and phonological processing is one of the forces that drives this left lateralization of what we call the visual word form area. Not everybody calls it this. It's a subject of debate. Somehow I don't think debates about what we call it are quite as interesting as the dynamics that happen within this domain of learning to read. I'll leave that at that. So it's great that we can use fMRI to start to look at these phenomena and to start to draw out, you know, activation curves that look at the bold response peaking at 5 seconds over time. But in order to link this directly to perceptual expertise, the phenomena that we want to capture in the expert reader, when reading starts to take on all the temporal dynamic processes of really a great engaging conversation with somebody you know really well, depends on this perceptual expertise of fluent word recognition. And there are a vast number of studies in educational and cognitive psychology showing intricate correlations between the dynamics of how somebody recognizes an individual word and how well they read overall. Their levels of comprehension are often tightly correlated between millisecond recordings of how well they read words. There's also a tremendous amount of eye tracking research and electrophysiology research suggesting that as a skilled reader is engaged in a novel, their eyes dart across the page and they make saccade level decisions about whether to linger a little bit longer on the word or to jump to the next word, suggesting that there's an eye-mind lag for response-relevant information within 200 milliseconds. They know enough about this word to make informed decisions about whether to look a little longer or whether to sort of program a saccade to the next word. We also know that this leads to automatic activation of phonological information and semantic information, even if you're not trying to. And further, that there's an integrated perception of visual word forms, such that entire word forms are encoded in about the same time that a single letter can be encoded. So we have to ask whether the specialization that we're seeing in this system is linked to account for these aspects of perceptual expertise. And that's where electrophysiology becomes a great converging methodology to look at these questions. We can see the spatial resolution of fMRI is helping us see the functional reorganization, but the electrophysiology is enabling us to look at a time course or a wave between a set of visual features which form the object of your expertise, in the case of a visual word in your language, in your script, versus a control stimulus. And we see a deviation in the N170, which shows great parallels to what we see in the perception of a human face and the expertise processes of integrating all the necessary aspects of human face to recognize individuals and other face-relevant information. Unlike faces, this N170 response is typically strongly left lateralized. And so we can start to look at, beyond just the temporal dynamics, we can start to look at the spatial dynamics to see not just what's happening at a single channel and how it deviates from the average of the entire array, but we can start to map out what's happening over the entire topography at a particular time point of 170 milliseconds when the information is responding quite differently for the object of your expertise versus the control. By looking at these topographies, we get lots of insight into the specific organization of this perceptual expertise. This is a snapshot of the voltage topography, average referenced at 170 milliseconds after an individual looks at a word in their language. And we can see this large negative deflection, stronger over the left hemisphere than the right hemisphere. Here's the response to a control stimulus for which they have no visual expertise. We see this right-dominated kind of novelty response. When you subtract the two and look at a statistical image, we see a large focal negativity over these left posterior regions and a large diffuse positivity at 170 milliseconds, suggesting that within this short amount of time, the brain has extracted enough information to differentiate this physical stimulation, which is associated with the expert activation of decision-relevant information, versus these control stimuli. Gary has a question.
I've often heard the confusion that negative means inhibition and positive means expectation, but
So there's simultaneous negative and positivity here in this same image. And I think that anytime you're able to surround the head with enough electrodes, you'll find that there's equal energy in the positive and negative.
Right, but people often hear talks about EEG and think that...
Sorry. People often hear talks about EEG, and I've heard fairly smart people say, oh, negative, that means inhibition.
Yeah, I don't think they're being very smart in that particular
instance. No. So I just wanted, there's a lot of smart people here who don't know about EEG.
Oh, okay. So
I just wanted to point that out.
Okay, yeah. So that's a very good point. But the thing that I wanted to stress here is that now that we know what the voltage topography looks like of this expertise effect, and we can tease this out, we can now use this as a probe to look at how are these brain systems being reorganized as children go through the typical process of becoming visual experts in reading. And Urs Maurer has been investigating this question. He was a postdoc in my group who's also done some extensive work in the German-speaking part of Switzerland, looking at children to see how the ERPs differ for words that they can recognize and letters that they can recognize versus control stimuli that they've never really seen before, first time they're showing it in their entire life. And he demonstrates that before the onset of formal training, which is actually delayed by a year in Switzerland relative to the United States, there's absolutely no difference, even if he marches this ERP analysis out to 300 milliseconds. He doesn't see any difference, even though the children can name the letters, they're familiar to them, they've had vast increases in exposure to letter stimuli in their environment versus these novel stimuli that they've never seen before. It doesn't lead to a gross ensemble change. However, after just a very short amount of experience, which is educationally directed in the context of formal schooling, these children show vast differences. Not as fast as the adults, it's about 220 milliseconds. This is the difference that I was showing you earlier. This is a radial plot. There's a little cartoon nose to orient you. But you can see this left lateralized negativity in the adults and this more diffuse positivity. In the first graders, they don't show any difference at 150 milliseconds. If you march out to 220 milliseconds, there are these large differences. The left lateralization doesn't seem evident in most first graders. So something is happening between first grade and adulthood, which is leading to this progressive left lateralization. And we're interested in that. But also something pretty amazing is happening just over the course of 1 year of formal schooling, in which governments and teachers and educators have found very specialized activities to help children pull off this reorganization. And we're very interested in the dynamics that cause that. There was an educational session today in which David was interacting with educators and kind of really pushing them to say, we've got these great fundamental insights into the typical development of the human brain. How can we now use these in the classroom? How can we use this information to change the way people are going about the education process and maybe change their success? And there's a lot of mystery and disconnect and kind of general statements that come out, which we really want to understand. How could we make these connections even tighter? And what I'd like to propose is that many of the insights that we're going to get is not by looking at the typical course of the development of the typical child as they go through this reorganization. That might give us some frameworks and some hints, but specifically useful insights into the process, I think we're going to come more from understanding individual differences between children. And just as there are huge individual differences in the way children react to the instruction, smile, to take their picture for the ERP wall, I don't know if we would call all these things a smile, but they seem to be cooperating and doing something. There are also large individual differences in the ERP responses that these children bring to our grand average when we try to study the central tendency. But I think that there's signal in that noise that's actually quite relevant to making educationally relevant insights into why children differ. Why are some children having such great difficulty pulling off this plastic reorganization of their auditory system with visual feature analysis, so that they can fluently recognize within 200 seconds which one out of what might be 50,000 potential language targets they're looking at. So one insight that we've had from this individual difference is that the left lateralization of the N170 may be informative at the individual level. It might really matter what's going on in the brain within 170 milliseconds of analyzing a visual word form. Might map onto significant individual differences that matter for children in schooling. We had a sample of children from New York City public schools that range from doing abysmally poor in third through fifth grade at decoding tasks. They were only able to guess about 25% of correct pronunciations of novel words they'd never seen before, all the way up to children who were doing quite amazing at this. And there was a strong correlation between the degree to which the N170 was left lateralized and how well they were doing on this task of reading novel words that they've never seen before. And this gives us some insight that there's meaningful individual differences in the brain dynamics that might give us some hints and clues into why is it that some children are struggling as third and fifth graders to read. One thing that we can say for sure is that what's going on during the first 170 milliseconds between when the word hits the retina and when the brain resonates and processes this information is already differentiating these children. And the reorganization which is happening for these cortical regions and this increased left lateralization may be tied to the success that they have. And we also know that what's going on, these computations that are unfolding at the speed of thought within the first 200 milliseconds are crucial to the global task of what children are trying to do of breaking into literacy so they can engage in text just as holistically as they engage in speeded conversation. Another aspect of cognitive neuroscience that I think is really going to benefit us understanding the changes that are occurring are thinking about the integration of organization of the language systems and small individual differences that might occur in the organization of responses to speech and the process of integrating vision and language together. And this sets up, I think April Benesich has some beautiful examples of this. This notion of neural prognosis, where by examining brain dynamics at time one, you can make predictions about how easy or difficult is it likely to be for that individual to reorganize their brain circuits in this experience-dependent way and predict their typical chances for success without intensive, really well-driven and focused interventions. So neuroprognosis is, in a sense, the best answer to the question, well, what is studying the brain ever going to tell you about something that we care about in educational processes? Because you can say, well, here directly, we've got more information from the brain state sometimes than we do from behavior itself. And one really great example of that is a study that Urs Maurer did following his postdoc with me. He went back to Switzerland and re-examined some of this left lateralization data based on some of the N170 effects we were showing. He had data from kindergartners that were listening to speech sounds on a mismatched negativity paradigm. They were listening to sound trains of sounds like da, 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 ta, da, da, ta, da, da, and looking at the deviant responses that occur when you change the phonemic identity. Just pure auditory stimulation. They were watching a silent movie, looking at how the brain responds to these deviant stimuli. But then he was able to track these kids for the next several years as they went through the process of reorganizing their brains for literacy. And what he found was a very strong correlation between the degree of left lateralization to this deviant speech sound and the number of words that they could read per minute when they were in second and third grade. And this, I think, gives us new insights into education, suggesting that individual differences in the neural dynamics of speech processing are, in a sense, giving you really useful and potentially actionable information about the reorganization process and how difficult it's likely to be, and what your typical chances for success are, for fluency. These children who are showing a very strong left lateralized late mismatch negativity response, this is a Loretta, or actually a source Loretta solution here, the degree to which their deviant response to speech sounds was left lateralized was a strong predictor of how many words they could read per minute. And this was very useful information for this study. It also was true for the children who were born genetically at risk for dyslexia, as well as the control group. It seemed to be a pervasive relationship across the entire group and provided, in some sense, a better prediction, additional information above and beyond what they could glean from the behavioral data that's typically collected on these kindergarten children. He looked at that. So he did an analysis that excluded left-handers and found that it didn't change the strength of the significant value other than the reduction in sample size that he had. But that's a great question. I probably shouldn't talk about this, but there's some pre-publication data suggesting there's a profound relationship between the pre-reading organization of hemispheric specialization for language and speech and this left lateralization of visual word form processing. Suggesting that there might be really strong principles of the organization of language as the predictor of which regions are going to find its neural niche in this competition for faces versus visual word recognition processes. One other aspect that we've been very interested in is, what is the basis of these individual differences? Why do the children differ? Can we look at different observables about the human brain in order to explain the sources of these individual variation in the physiology, or is it a just-so story that children differ in their physiology and that difference is going to cause it? There's a tremendous potential now to link individual variation in human anatomy to individual variation in physiological responses in brain networks. Diffusion tensor imaging is giving us great insights into this. Instead of just looking at white matter and measuring its volume, we can start to look at some of the properties by which the organization of white matter tract structures and the glia, the astrocytes and the myelination processes, are restricting the diffusion of water along these tracts versus across these tracts and giving us measures of fractional anisotropy. And one of the most astounding things to come out of this, that it's actually changed my whole worldview on individual differences, is that there are small statistical variations in white matter tracts from one person to the next that map onto, in a really powerful way, subtle individual variations in the efficiency of certain cognitive processes. This kind of goes against our general cultural embracing of Cartesian dualism in the normal state. We all tend to think we have a category of intact human brain, and we have a category of variations in intellectual ability and efficiencies, and these things have nothing to do with each other. Okay, everybody will say if you hit your head in a motorcycle accident, they have a lot to do with each other. But in the case of the normal human brain, normal human variation, we're very slow to accept this notion that subtle statistical variations in our white matter tracts and the organization of these circuits map onto things that decide which school you get into or how well you're doing on a standardized test for reading. These relationships here, if you look at the fractional anisotropy of the superior coronary ideata in the left hemisphere, shows a profound relationship with standardized test of children's word reading ability. So in a sense, this is a great cognitive neuroscience graph where on one axis we have individual variation in cognition, on the other axis we have individual variation in the degree to which glial structures are restricting the diffusion of water molecules across the boundaries of a white matter tract. And there's a profound relationship between these anatomical, micro-anatomical observations and efficiencies in human thought as it comes to visual word recognition. This particular relationship, the most stunning thing about it for me is that it's been replicating consistently across multiple studies. There are now 6 independent studies from 5 independent laboratories that have found confirmation of this very finding. And one of them that was most striking, this from my laboratory wasn't necessarily the most striking other than the fact that it had a large collection of children who were testing down in the disabled range of reading disabilities. There were greater than 1 standard deviation below the test norm. But another group that was studying near Lake Wobegon in Canada, where all the children were above average, demonstrated the very same relationship, and they did an entire brain scan search of the DTI tracts that showed the greatest difference and found the very same region of interest that we found in our study, explaining individual variation from the normal range all the way down into the disabled range in my study. And now there are 6 independent studies that have found this same relationship, and people are trying to struggle to really see what is the functional significance of this anatomical difference on the physiology. We know that it's most commonly found in the left hemisphere. 2 of the studies have found that individual variation in the lateralization of this, so if you compare this structure to its right homologue, that variation is predictive at a subject-by-subject level of just how it is, how the degree of fraction anisotropy in the left versus the right. But we don't really know. We're still kind of searching and exploring this. We do know that it's also cognitively and anatomically very specific. So you might think, well, if a child has screwed up white matter, they're going to do bad at everything that's cognitive. After all, the brain is the organ of cognition. However, there's great specificity in this reading relationship to this left superior coronariata tract, because when we look at individual variation in short-term memory, which shows beautiful correlations in frontal lobes, in this anterior coronariata tract, we see a very similar relationship, same population of children, showing really profound relationships across both. When you look at the other tracts, or the other cognitive function, we see evidence of both cognitive and anatomical specificity, suggesting that these tracts are really performing very different computations. An individual variation in this tract doesn't really tell you much about variation in another cognitive domain, or very much, a little bit, there's some base level correlation of anatomical variation in white matter tracts in other structures. So we're very interested in, you know, this, the fact that the outcome of an educational process of trying to learn to read over multiple years is related to anatomical variation in this white matter tract. But our agenda is to try to link this to more profound or more direct individual differences in children. And one thing that this investigation has led us to look at more specifically is phonological processing differences in children. This is, in a sense, jargon. It's, in a sense, a mouthful. But if you think about the mind's ability to manipulate speech sounds, to identify symbolic units within speech and then to manipulate them, you could identify several different types of dynamics that are really important for this. One, you could think about the analysis and synthesis of parts into wholes. So the individual parts within a word like Germany and being able to manipulate them and pull out the ma and now stitch them together and create a new word. Anybody? Okay, if you guys aren't going to listen, I'm not going to. No. So I want you to use your brain to focus on the word Germany, but not just to think about the country, but to think about the sounds and the form of that linguistic utterance. And if you take out the ma, could you create a new word by stitching up the remaining parts into a journey? Very good. Okay, that's all I was looking for. Anyway, analysis and synthesis is very different from other things that you might try to do, like a phone number. Here's a string of syllables that you have to remember and then give back to me. How many syllables can you hold on to in the correct order? Another aspect is this aspect of rapid letter naming, in which you're looking at letters or colors or some other picture, and you're rapidly saying the identity of each and how quickly can you juggle those. It turns out that these account for different variants in reading. They pull out different populations of children, but we see that this left superior coronariata is loading very heavily on analysis and synthesis, but no loading at all on short-term memory, digit span, no loading at all on rapid letter naming. There's this average anterior coronariata region is loading quite heavily on short-term memory. It's predicting how many digits will a child be able to repeat back in the correct order just by knowing the microstructural properties of the way water is diffusing through the frontal lobe that's restricted by the organization of glial cells that lead to different individual differences in properties of white matter tracts. So linking this back to education, we can see that, wow, there are really large individual differences in anatomy that seem to have direct links to cognitive function that are relevant for education, for the foundations of education. Literacy reorganizes the human brain to allow these new abilities. How can we link this beyond just the fact, oh, tough luck, people differ? Is this, in a sense, a case of manifest destiny where I was born short, so I'll never be a basketball player, or I was born with really weak fractional anisotropy in this particular brain region? Or is there something that we can do about this to focus on the educational potential of these very particular brain insights for these very particular computations that we know from a lot of analyses that end up being foundational for the rest of human intellectual development that happens through schooling? This is a graph, a correlation graph, of activation levels of children with different phonological awareness skills. So we brought in a kid with large variations in how well they could play with the sounds of language in this analysis and synthesis sense. And we looked at how that individual variation would impact brain activity in left fusiform gyrus, what I like to call the visual word form area. Other people don't like me to call it the visual word form area, as well as this left superior temporal gyrus region associated with secondary and tertiary auditory cortices that are crucial for processing the sounds of language. This is a correlation map showing that there's a really strong correlation between kids' language play, their ability to use their attention to focus on the sounds of language, and the degree of activation when they're looking at novel visual word forms in a one-back task. Now, we might think that the anatomical differences that we saw and the neural prognosis differences that we saw about how children are activating this late mismatch negativity are all just showing us that there's one strong, durative individual difference that kids, children are going to carry forward. But what I'd like to propose is that there are also other neural dynamics and suggest that the way children are focusing their attention during learning experiences may have a neuromodulatory effect. And in that learning instance, that neuromodulatory effect could act as a gain control, increasing neural activity within a particular circuit. And over time, that could change the temporal dynamics of learning in terms of how well children are breaking into literacy and learning to read. So I want to just walk you through this really quickly, but part of this is really motivated by very careful scholarship that's been applied to education on the very significant question of children's early literacy. So there has been, National Reading Panel has gotten together and looked, poured over literally thousands of studies looking at variation in how academic practices for teaching children to learn to read. And one of the most profound insights about this study that's been reported widely is that in these meta-analyses where we can look at effect sizes, that there are curriculum effects. The curriculum that you choose for children has a profound impact on how well they do. And the dimension of these curriculum effects suggests that growth in reading and decoding skills are linked to the proportion of educational activities that draw children's attention to letter-sound relationships, the relationships between individual letters within visual word forms and the particular sounds that they make within human vocalizations. These effect sizes are pretty big. They're bigger the younger that you go. They tend to be bigger if you include children who are quote unquote at risk for economic reasons or genetic reasons. They also are highly convergent with other findings in which people have gone in and actually looked at and observed moment by moment the number of minutes or seconds a teacher is spending on different dimensions of educational activities. Fred Morrison and others have this beautiful research program demonstrating that school year growth in reading and decoding skills is specifically linked to the number of minutes that the teacher is explicitly focusing a child's attention on letter-sound relationships. This is especially true for children who are have lower vocabulary scores and are doing worse on language in general. There is an exception to this for children who are doing incredibly well. The number of minutes that the parents or the teachers spend on these focusing attention on letter-sound relationships is actually negatively correlated with their achievement. These are the high-achieving children who would do much better off if you just stop drilling them and let them read. So this led us to really think about, you know, could we take these educational insights into this? These are hard-won observations at a population level about the dynamics of reorganizing human brains in the real world. Could we take this to refine our scientific questions, to maybe ask if we could isolate the effects of selectively attending to the phonology in words in the service of reading or rhyming tasks or things like this? And so this led our research group in a really different direction that we weren't expecting to go in, but we really thought if we were going to make a scientific account of this, we really need to isolate, using paradigms from Desmond and Duncan and others, this notion of selectively attending to one form of information when there may be many other alternative things that you could be focusing on. So I want to walk you through a little detour and then return back to the educational dynamics after Gary turns his phone off. Thanks. The reason I say that is because I need you to listen very, very carefully to the sounds that you're about to hear. So I want you to listen and focus your attention, your volitional attention, not on my voice, not on what Gary is doing with his phone, but specifically on the sound structure of the words that you hear. You're going to hear two auditory words, and I want you to tell me just, do they rhyme or not? So lop off the first consonant. It has nothing to do with the similarity space that I care about. Just tell me whether the remaining vowel and final consonant is the same in these two vocalizations.
Bays. Noise.
No, people are shaking their head. Okay, great. So you're all able to do that. Did the tones that were played simultaneously with those, were they the same tones or did they change? Did the tones rhyme as well? Were the ends of those tones the same or not? Okay, some people think that they were, yeah, some people think they were different. Let me play them again. I promise I didn't change the sounds.
Bays. Noise.
So, volitionally focusing your attention on one form of information versus another changes your information processing dynamics. It also changes brain dynamics in very specific ways, and we can now investigate that using functional neuroimaging in order to look at this question of the integration of phonology and orthography, which allow us to do this kind of analysis. And what we do in this study is we take people, they listening to the same exact stimuli, and they were just looking at a blue cross or a red cross. And if the blue cross, you might think of the blues, and you listen to the tones, but it's counterbalanced, so you have to come up with another mnemonic. And when you subtract these two, it's the same exact stimuli. These are equally difficult decisions if you look at the reaction time dynamics and the accuracy profiles. But listening to the phonological information, this rhyme-focused condition, selectively attending to that phonological information drives intensive activity in this left lateralized brain network, including all of the normal suspects in reading, including these frontal regions, these superior temporal gyrus and mid-temporal gyrus regions, as well as, kind of surprisingly, this region of the visual system. Even though there was no visual stimulation in this experiment, we're just asking you to listen to auditory words. When you focus your attention on the phonology of words, there's increased activity in this region of the visual system, which is driven in this top-down fashion. Same exact stimulation, same equal challenge of actively listen to these auditory stimuli, but we're changing the domain of the computation which takes place. And when we draw this out, we look at the fusiform gyrus to see which aspect of the visual system was impacted by this. We find this incredibly focal effect. We see absolutely no difference in the anterior, the mid, or the posterior gyrus in the right hemisphere. We see absolutely no difference in the anterior region of the fusiform gyrus in the left hemisphere. We see absolutely no difference in the posterior region. We see a large, significant difference in this mid-fusiform gyrus region, which I like to call the visual word form area, but it sounds ridiculous to call this the visual word form area. There was no vision involved in this. People were just listening to these speech sounds, suggesting to me that there may be a reentrant process, that the aspect of focusing your attention on phonological analysis leads to recruitment of regions which may be involved in encoding spelling patterns within these words. So, but who knows when this took place? We've got this big, temporally sloppy, bold signal, which is peaking at 5 seconds. I mean, this incredible amount of activity. You might wonder whether to really make this story work, to really understand this, we'd have to know, is this something that's just happening really, really late in the process of listening to these two stimuli, making up your mind whether they respond or not, and then making a decision? Or is this something that focusing your attention on auditory speech stimuli actually modulates the brain activity during the listening of the second stimulus, or maybe even during the processing of the end of the very first stimulus? And we're not able to really use fMRI. The temporal dynamics just don't work in this particular context. But ERP to the rescue, we can use converging evidence from ERP to specifically look at this question of when is it that volitionally focusing on the phonology, the rhyme decision, versus volitionally focusing on the temporal, the tones, when does that modulate? And just advanced and showed you the answer. So when we do individual by individual, there were 16 subjects in this experiment, We do source localization on each one of them, and then do statistical analysis on those source solutions with a multiple comparisons correction for every single time point in this entire window. And we find still a very robust FDR-corrected significant result, specifically in the left hemisphere, that's happening as you listen to the first word in this stimulus train. You're not making any decision. You're not making any comparison. You're not pressing a button. You're not reflecting. This is simultaneous with the end of these sound codes, suggesting that people are modulating the way information is processing dynamically as the stimuli are occurring. This is a powerful neural modulation of attention. And yeah. So the typical stimuli last about 650 milliseconds. There's three tones embedded in them with small gaps in between them. What's that?
I'm just wondering how long the gaps are.
Oh, I think the gaps are about 100 milliseconds. Okay. So it's not quite in your temporally crowded window.
Okay.
So people, nobody has problems telling me how many tones there were or separating them out. So we specifically looked at your work and avoided that kind of window because we wanted everybody to be able to hear the tones.
You avoided the phonology area, right?
What?
You avoided the acoustics that are related to the phonology.
Yeah, that could complicate things.
Gosh.
Could. Not necessarily would. Okay, so we can also ask, what about the stimulus properties? Half of these words rhymed, half of these words didn't rhyme. We can see as you're processing this information and suddenly you're differentiating a second stimulus which has matching properties in phonology versus has deviant properties in phonology, what is the temporal processing by which the brain signal starts to differentiate those two cases? We can see online kind of stimulus-specific information during the second stimulus. So here we analyze the second stimulus in the sequence. We can see the global field power over the entire head produces this large spike corresponding to the N1, and then a large spike, a late positive complex that occurs very late in stimulation, and we're interested in kind of both of those. There's a rhyming effect. This is ubiquitous throughout the N400 literature, suggesting that words that rhyme modulate electrophysiology responses around 400 milliseconds to 500 milliseconds after the stimulus. And here we see this modulation where we see increased positivity if the second word rhymes versus if it doesn't rhyme. And we're curious whether this is driven by the organization of the human auditory system, perceptual expertise for auditory words in the phonological domain, or whether this is driven by the dynamics of attention. It may be that just the task of asking people to focus on the phonology of words, we already saw that it modulated the way they encoded the very first stimulus. Does it also modulate this N400 response for rhymes? And many people have thought that there may be just acoustic similarities between rhyming words that drive these effects. And others have suggested that the very task of rhyming is a very special task. It was kind of developed concurrently with the very challenge of encoding literacy in large populations, and that pre-literate cultures don't really do anything that you could call rhyming. Here, we find really powerful evidence that if we just had people focus on the melodies and played them the same exact stimuli, the rhyme effect was decimated. No trace of rhyming effects across these stimuli, which gives us some insight. 5 minutes. Okay, let me jump ahead. We followed this up. This is Jay McClellan would have loved this, but he's gone, so I'm going to skip over it. There are these late orthographic effects. When people make decisions about auditory rhyming words, the associated spellings come along for the ride, even though we try to ignore them. So if I ask you to tell me whether kite and fight rhyme, even though I said ite and ite twice, and your auditory cortex heard ite and ite twice, because the associated spellings are different, there's an increase in the reaction time. It's if I ask you whether couch and touch rhyme, and I've clearly said ouch and utch, and clearly they don't rhyme, their shared associated orthography also drives differences. And we can see these effects as well in our ERP task. If I give you the first word is fed and the second word is either bed or head, these equally rhyme, but one has an associated phonology which is congruent and the other incongruent. And if I ask you fed and pet versus fed and sweat, there's also this congruence and incongruence in the orthography. This effect shows up pretty robustly in reaction times, suggesting that our orthographic information, the knowledge that we have about the way auditory words are represented in spelling of letters, influences our decisions about rhyming. It's also completely decimated if you take attention away, suggesting that there's very little case to be made for strong automaticity of these relationships. And that's really important in a way, because it might suggest that the way a child is focusing their attention during literacy activities, if they're focusing on the entire word or the sounds of the voice or many, many, many things that they can focus on, if they're not focusing on the very central information of phonological codes and how they map to visual orthography, if somehow the educational experience hasn't led them to focus their mind on that, they may not be driving these the reorganization of this circuit as we see. So we're doing specific work on this in order to look in the laboratory about the effects of people learning a brand new language under conditions in which the teacher focuses their attention on the phonology and how it links to letter sounds versus having them focus on entire syllables and mapping them to these hieroglyphic characters. And the way we do this is a little bit sneaky. We have people learn a whole bunch of characters and associate them with words. They get 4 seconds to study each one, and then we give them rigorous testing. But we don't really tell them that the words were made with this little hidden alphabet where each little letter segment could, if you try, be associated with phonology. And just the simple difference of focusing attention one way has a tremendous impact on learning rate, on generalization of learning, as well as brain activity. And I want to just jump to this last slide to keep us on time. This is what I showed you at the beginning of the talk, where if you're looking at the object of your expertise, a word in your native script, we see this left lateralized organization within 170 milliseconds. But within that same control stimulus leads to this right lateralized pattern. These novel stimuli that people have studied and have just learned under these two attentional conditions, they had equal time to study them. They're the same exact materials in every way. The only difference was whether the teacher told them to focus their attention one way or focus their attention another way had a profound impact on the organization of electrophysiological responses a little bit later, around 190 to 210 milliseconds after stimulation, versus if they were in this whole word focus, suggesting that the way a teacher focuses attention may have strong modulatory effects on activation during learning, and that the summed aggregate impact on the reorganization of the brain can be determined by those modulatory influences. Teachers, the strongest tool a teacher has is focusing children's attention on salient information, and this may lead to reorganization of brain circuits that support literacy. Finally, I'd like to end on a translational note. We've been involved with the University of Pittsburgh Learning Research and Development Center for many years to develop ways of taking really effective teacher tools for focusing children's attention on not just language and not just visual word forms, but the relationship between letters within very specific positions within a word and analysis of the phonology of those words, and turn it into educational software that children can use for dozens of sessions and look at the impact that it has on their overall literacy development. And this is a little bit of what some of the software looks like. Some of the techniques that teachers sometimes use, tying into some of the first sessions that we had, are visual motion. If you want to focus a child's attention on individual letter units, you can ask them to drag the letter units around, put their hand on a letter card, and drag it into a specific position so that this position becomes incredibly salient, and map that to the change that it makes in a word pronunciation. This has a profound impact on children's reading and decoding ability. There are scores for being able to decode novel words based on these letter combinations increased pretty dramatically, something that we model as being the impact of about 1.5 years of successive schooling for these children that are struggling. And when we look at a position analysis of where the letters were in the word forms that they're trying to decode, they start off with pretty good success in the first position, but then it falls off rapidly for anything past the first letter. This intervention has a profound impact on every single position within a visual word form as it maps correctly to the pronunciation. This was a randomized control waiting list study in which every child wanted to be in the study was given a date that the study started, but then half of them got a lottery ticket that let them start early, and we compared the development over that lottery ticket period, and we found that the word-building intervention that we used led to a really dramatic change in their standardized scores. There was no change at all in the waiting list control over this period, even though they were getting tutoring and getting lots of attention, that reading was really important. This was a pilot study, I'm being told to stop, that suggests that there were changes over this training period, specifically within these left superior temporal gyrus regions. And finally, to bring the talk full circle and to maybe spark a couple conversations at dinner, how is it that these observations and these particular insights and the synergy between what we're doing at the individual child level and the educational software and what we're seeing at the brain dynamics level could actually be applied to a problem at this level of observation? We're working, we have a grant and an ongoing project with the New York City public school systems to give this software to children and to compare it to New York City's sort of practice as usual tutoring program that they give to children who are struggling with reading, where they pair them up with an adult and they pick out books and they work on comprehension skills. And what we're finding in this test, sort of in the wild, if you will, training up tutors, we just give them the program with a one-hour orientation and they go off and work with the children, is that we're able to fully replicate our laboratory findings of intervention using this software, just as we saw in the laboratory. We're able to see in a randomized active control study in schools where we randomize kids and tutors, and they're working in a very complex environment. And so I think I will stop there and just kind of suggest that together with the science of learning, as we start to investigate principles that we think can actually translate and surpass these levels of complexity in order to get communication between what people are doing at an entire societal level of taking a whole generation of children and trying to help them all reorganize their brains for fluent literacy, these particular insights might start to take hold, and we really need a new field to map these levels of complexity. And I like to call this field educational neuroscience. Some people don't like me to call it that. They want me to call it mind, brain, and education. But I suggest that one pathway to connect these levels of complexity may be the cultural artifacts that we as scientists can actually have a role in shaping. These cultural artifacts of inner edutainment software for children. We can control the temporal dynamics of it. We can control the spacing of the practice. We can control the adaptive elements of the curriculum in order to let a live tutor focus on the holistic child who's on this journey of reorganizing their brain circuits and connecting with literacy and face-to-face interaction, and let the software handle all of the temporal dynamics of learning in order to embed these insights into much larger, more complex social environments that we call education. So I'm going to stop there, but thank you all for your attention.